Hey, it's David Weiner, writer and director of In Search of Darkness, 1990 to 1994, and you are listening to The Graveyard Show.
Welcome to The Graveyard.
And welcome to another edition of the Graveyard Show podcast. I am your caretaker, and the graveyard is open. Well, it is now official. Halloween is here. We are in the month of October and on the road to October 31st. And as you heard at the top of the show, David Weiner, the director of In Search of Darkness, Part 1, 2, and 3, as well as the In Search of Tomorrow documentary, all those about 80s horror and 80s sci-fi. Well, he will be joining me in just a minute to talk about his latest addition to the In Search of Darkness series, as you heard him say, In Search of Darkness 1990 through 1994. We're going to talk about the movie, and we're also going to get into how you can pre-order the film as well. It is a limited amount of time which you can do it, so we will get you those details during the interview. And then what I always do after I interview David on these pre-order shows is I will go through the different bundles that you can purchase for the pre-order, because they always have, they being Creator VC, they always put together these great bundles that you can purchase for the pre-order of the film. It could either be the movie itself, either on Blu-ray or on DVD, digitally, and then you can get all the other goodies as well. So I will get into that on the other side of the David Weiner interview. It's always great having David here. He's always been a great friend of the show. I always enjoy my conversations with him, and I'm not going to waste too much time getting to that interview. Very quickly, I hope you've been following the Graveyard Show podcast here as a podcast or on the YouTube channel. Tons and tons of stuff that I've been uploading for the month of September, and even more coming in the month of October. Now, unfortunately, my last podcast, I said that an interview that was supposed to be featured on there did not happen. I don't want to jinx anything, but I'm in the process of putting maybe another interview together to make up for that, as well as maybe two. We'll see. So still working here on getting you more Halloween content. So you have all the GYS classics that I've been uploading. You have on YouTube, you have all the different movie trailers that I've been uploading, as well as my picks for the movies that I wanted to see featured in Search of Darkness 1990 through 94. David and I are going to talk about that, because he saw that video and he has some comments on those movies that I selected. There's just a lot of stuff up on the YouTube channel, as well as the new Catacombs of Horror video production that I do. I'm currently editing the latest edition, which is my favorite scenes from the 1972 vampire movie Blackula. So stay tuned for that. I'm hoping to get that up by Halloween, but we shall see. In the meantime, I'm not going to waste any more time, because as you hear in the background, we're welcoming a friend back to the show. And when that happens, that means my guest is here, and it's time for me to get to work. Well, it's that time again to welcome a friend of the podcast back to the show. Director David Weiner is back to talk about In Search of Darkness, but now we are moving on from the 1980s and stepping into the 1990s with this next chapter in the series, In Search of Darkness, 1990 to 1994. David, it's great having you back. Happy Halloween.
Sweater weather, crunchy leaves, freshly dug graves. Like, I would not have it any other way.
Our favorite time of year. So now we're moving into the 1990s with this latest In Search of Darkness film. Did it just make sense to continue with that decade?
Well, we had talked about it for quite some time. You know, every time you make a documentary, it takes a long time to put it together. Anyone who knows anything about filmmaking knows that these things are long time in the planning and in the execution of it. And every time people said more In Search of Darkness, we're like, okay, we'll do another 80s. Okay, we'll do another 80s. And, you know, the fact that the audience demanded more, and we were able to do a trilogy of movies about the 80s to equal about 14 plus hours, to attempt to explore a decade, but even then, not fully. We kept on saying, well, what's next? And a lot of people were saying, all right, I think it's time for you to go to the 90s. But a lot of people were like, oh, the 70s, oh, the classic, you know, Universal Monsters era, you know, through Hammer Horror, through today. What, you know, what are you going to do next? And so we ultimately kind of looked at the writing on the wall, and the demand for 90s has been absolutely overwhelming. And I think that is really a cool thing, because I think a lot of the people who were very fixated on how amazing the 80s horror was, and the output and the revolutionary filmmaking that took place then, it really sort of steals the thunder from the 1990s. You know, the 1990s was really kind of a transition decade for horror, because I think a lot of people were sort of getting a bit of horror fatigue and genre fatigue by then, but the fans just were lapping it up. So there was sort of this this sort of dichotomy between what was going on in theaters versus what was going on the video shelves. There's lots to explore.
Whenever a new decade is starting, there's still some influence from the previous decade. So making this movie, was there that definitive moment when you said, okay, we are now into 1990s horror, we're out of the 80s?
There is a definitive moment, but that's also amid a real sort of gray definitive line, you know, line that's not definitive. You know, if you look at the early 90s, it really still feels like the 80s for a lot of the films that were going on, especially because there was such an influx of straight-to-video content, you know, by the likes of, you know, Full Moon Entertainment and Roger Corman and Lloyd Kaufman and those pioneers. But I would say, out of the gate, Hollywood was starting to really recognize the value of horror. They just didn't want to call it horror. They wanted to call everything a thriller, because they thought horror was a bad word. But you have movies early on, 1990, 1991, everything from, you know, Misery by Rob Reiner, Stephen King's Misery, to Silence of the Lambs, where basically a Thomas Harris serial killer movie has turned Hollywood on its ear, because it just won everything at the Oscars. It won every award practically that it was up for. And everyone was basically saying, wait a minute, you could do a horror movie, but you could do a high-level, quote-unquote, elevated horror movie, before they actually used that word, thank God. And it really made an absolute difference in what other filmmakers were looking at as what they could get away with. But still, the studios were a little gun-shy, and so they were calling half the stuff thrillers versus a horror film. But horror fans know the difference.
I've recently heard the 1990s described as the lost decade of horror. I was kind of surprised to hear that, considering how mainstream cable TV and home video rentals were. Was the lost decade something you had heard previously? And why is it called that?
It's sort of one of those easy to define the decade as a lost decade, because I think a lot of people overlook it. They say, well, in terms of horror, there wasn't much good until Scream came along, and then we got Ghostface and we were good to go. You know, that's the reductive, you know, looking back 30 years ago and saying, yeah, that's kind of all there was. But upon closer inspection, there was just an absolute explosion of amazing filmmaking from all different avenues, from the highest levels to the most indie that was available. And there was a huge amount of stuff, but a lot of it was arguably lost because it wasn't in the box office, it was on the video shelves. But there was still plenty of stuff available. I mean, the studios decided to reinvent all the classic monsters with A-list talent, you know? So you have Francis Ford Coppola doing, Bram Stoker's Dracula. You have Kenneth Branagh, who's like, I want to do Frankenstein, so we'll call it Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, because, if you have that literary element to it, it elevates it to a certain audience that wouldn't normally go to see movies like this. You have Jack Nicholson deciding, I want to play a werewolf, and does Wolf, James Spader and Michelle Pfeiffer. It's really high level stuff. I don't know. There's a huge amount of material there.
Yeah, yeah. I loved Wolf. Mike Nichols, by the way, directed Wolf,
yes.
For those that don't know, which is kind of crazy, right?
Like, it was not The Graduate, I can tell you that.
Exactly. And it's just kind of one of those things. I know that, to me, like, the 1990s seemed to be sort of that final bridge between, like, the horror of the late 20th century into maybe the last 15 years. What are we, 23 now? I don't even know what year we're in anymore. But to me, it always felt like, to me, like the early 2000s was kind of like that lost time for horror, where we were kind of trying to figure out, like, what was next. You have the old franchises, and then it's like, well, what are we doing? You had all the remakes and all these reboots, and it just kind of felt like the genre itself was lost.
Well, another reason, if I could just interject, is I think people feel like it's a lost decade because practical effects, which was at its zenith by that point, especially after all the amazing effects masters cut their teeth, like Rick Baker and Tom Savini and so on, they cut their teeth, on creating the best effects possible. All of a sudden, you have this seismic shift, it's the watershed moment. Jurassic Park comes out, prior to that, and we don't have to go through the CGI 101, but, James Cameron was toying around with all sorts of things with, The Abyss and Terminator 2, but then Jurassic Park comes around, and what happens is everyone sees it. It's a massive hit. It's a cultural phenomenon. And everyone says, wait, you don't have to make them. You can make them out of a computer. But what they didn't quite realize was Stan Winston made these life-size dinosaurs practically. And it was very seamlessly melded. Maybe arguably you could see some of the seams more now. But at the time, no one knew, could see where the practical effects ended and the CGI began, save for maybe one or two scenes.
Sure.
And so because of that, everyone said, I want that. You could do that? I want that too. And so there was a very rough baby steps stage for effects that really permeated the 90s pretty much throughout the entire decade. They did get better and better. Sometimes they were seamless if they didn't draw full attention to themselves. But it's really awkward. You have to remember back then it wasn't just CGI or CG. It was morphing. Everything was morphing. You'd morph from one thing to another. So, listen, we need something that morphs in here. Hey, let's make sleepwalkers and morph the guy into a cat creature while he's driving. That'll look cool, It doesn't age well at all now. But I would argue that some of that stuff is really fun to watch now because you could see the technology trying. You could see the technology pushing. You could see the producers trying to take an opportunity to really create some imaginative visuals and put them on film. Now, they're very clunky, but arguably, it's kind of like when you look at 8-bit video games. You don't dismiss it. You just recognize that it was the baby steps from the beginning.
Yeah. And you mentioned two of the greatest movies of that time, of all time, Jurassic Park and Terminator 2. And when those came out, what they were like to see in the theaters, and it was like, oh my god! Like, especially
T2. It was jaw dropping.
Yeah,
jaw dropping. We're so used to it now, but back then, just to your point, it's one of those things where people who were there say this blew my mind, and people now say, but everything looks great now. That looks so fake. So it's the same thing with King Kong and stop motion animation. Mm-hmm. Like, that's all you had, Ray Harryhausen, I grew up with the amazing effects of Ray Harryhausen and, Willis O'Brien, and that just captured my imagination. And sure, it looked a little wonky, but that's all I got. And so my imagination went with it. And so it's kind of cool to be able to look back and say, we were there, you and I, at least, you know, when yes. some of these things were happening.
Well, you know, what's so funny is that you kind of hear some of that argument now, right, with some movies, without naming movies and TV series that are out, where you hear criticism like, oh, this looks like they're in front of an LED screen. Oh, this looks like they're in front of a bad green screen. Oh, this is just bad CG. So it's kind of funny, right? We're in this time period where we have all this technology and we can do stuff. And you see some of these movies now where you're like, oh, my God, that's incredible. And yet you still have some of that criticism where people are like, oh, that looks fake. Oh, that's too much CG.
Well, the thing is, once you become savvy to how it's done, you start looking for it. And, you know, I'll give you a perfect example that just I experienced yesterday. I was watching Ahsoka, you know, on Disney
yep.
Plus.
Uh-huh.
I was just, it looks great, you know, regardless of what you think of the story and the series. It's Star Wars, and they're on, you know, alien planets, and there's practical effects that they're using that are sweetened by CG. Everything looks amazing. But the thing is, I now, of course, know that a lot of the effects they do are practical in a giant room. There's a certain name for it, and it escapes me. Maybe you can tell me, but if not. Basically, from The Mandalorian on, they basically shoot practical sets with a fake background,
yeah.
and the fake background is all computer generated, but it's live. So as they're moving around, the perspective is constantly changing, so it looks like they're there.
Yeah.
You know, that's why you have these amazing, looks like they went to, you know, Tunisia to shoot this stuff.
Yeah.
Well, this was the first time, as I was watching this, where there was a moment where I looked and I'm like, I think I can see the fake background. It was one shot, because I wasn't even thinking about it and looking for it. But there was one shot that just felt a little bit off. And I'm like, oh, I'm remembering they're on this kind of soundstage, you know,
yeah.
this 360 soundstage. And so, listen, at a certain point, I know we've gotten into extremely sidetracked territory.
But that's why I love talking to you.
But anyway, back to 90s horror.
Yes.
But, you know, it's amazing because that's a decade where yes. when you look at the evolution of the effects, you could see the growing pains, and that's pretty cool.
Well, let's talk about the movie itself. So the 1980s version of In Search of Darkness, you decided to do, as you mentioned, you did the trilogy, but you did, within the movie, you did a year-to-year look back at the movies that came out in those particular years from 80 to 89. With
mm-hmm.
this version, you've decided to do the first film from 1990 to 94, and then part two would be 95 to 99. So
yep.
how did that decision get made?
That's a decision where, working with Robin Block, the executive producer, we just decided that these things, although they are a labor of love, it is an incredible feat to put together a whole decade, a 4 to 5 hour film, and turn it around in essentially a year. It's just backbreaking. That doesn't mean that this is going to be a short film, but there's something about the structure where we can sort of extend it. So rather than doing, because what happens is, you know, because there's just so much ground to cover, when you try and do 10 years plus chapters in between, you feel like you are just kind of racing through the content, and you're like, well, I'll get to more when I do the whole thing again for part two or part three. This time we're trying an experiment where we get to fit in more in one film in terms of a half a decade. And so it's almost like if you get two films together, it's the equivalent of getting maybe three films in terms of the content. So it's a new approach we're taking. It's also giving me some liberty to, with and flexibility with the construct that we put together, the formula, so to speak. I want to add television. And integrate some, because there's so many, you know, Stephen King miniseries. You've got It, you've got The Stand, you know, Tommyknockers and so on. You've got Tales from the Crypt. You have gateway horror, you know, like Erie, Indiana, you know, The
mm-hmm.
X-Files.
Yeah.
There's just so much there that I just, you know, when it came to tackling all of that content in a decade, I made a very specific decision with the trilogy, the 80s trilogy, to not do television. But this time around, I don't want to ignore it, and I want to include it. So it gives me some flexibility there as well.
So Creator VC immediately reached out to fans to help with the collaborative process once the movie was announced. Talk to me about the decision to make that, and how has the response been?
the response has been overwhelmingly amazing, and it's one of those things where I welcome it. It's very constructive for me to not be working in a vacuum when I am looking at just a huge amount of titles to choose from and to sift through. You know, what are the ones that people care about? You know, what are the ones that are not so obvious that people want? You know, which, if I had to choose between Child's Play 2 and Child's Play 3, you know, I've learned that Child's Play 2 by far is the one that people love more, you know, okay. Just by a survey. And so, you know, or I'll say something like, you know, do you guys want to do more of the 80s icons, you know, Pinhead and Chucky and, you know, Jason, or are you kind of over that and you want to just bring in the new, you know, like Candyman and Pennywise and so on and so forth? And there's also an overwhelming response that people want to keep the 80s party going in terms of the, you know, the iconic villains. And so all this stuff, the response has been amazing, and the information is very helpful to me in helping to craft the ultimate documentary that I think people will connect with. And we've been doing this pretty much since the In Search of Darkness Part 2. We started doing it, but not very vocally. And In Search of Darkness 3, we did it very vocally. And the response has been very helpful and very great. And so it's really nice to be able to incorporate the fans, the movie lovers, the people who care, to feel like they're part of this and feel seen. And I'm very happy. It's not editing by committee. It's informing the content, and it's very helpful.
Yeah, I actually, well, you saw it. I did a video for the Graveyard Show podcast.
I saw that. You couldn't pick one.
I'm like I said, I'm special. I have to be able to get 10.
I think that's good.
So,
well, you had great choices.
Well, thank
some
you.
Some eclectic choices, too.
Yeah. You know, it really took me some time to kind of figure some stuff out, because I was like, well, it's too easy to go Silence of the Lambs, Candyman. Like, you know that those are going to be in the movie, right? At least I would hope that people would be like,
maybe yeah, not. You know, you didn't mention it, so I think I'll just, you know, pass on them.
But yeah, I did. For those that didn't see it, it's fine. I'll just go through them really quickly. So my 10 in alphabetical order were Abel Ferrara's version of the Body Snatchers, Kronos, Exorcist 3, Frankenhooker.
Yes, of course. Henning Lotter's Frankenhooker.
In the Mouth of Madness, It, Jason Goes to Hell, Night of the Living Dead remake from 1990, and Stephen King's The Stand miniseries, and either of the subspecies 1, 2, or 3 films, because that was
very
10,
very
so.
Cool. You hit the spectrum, and I'm not going to confirm or deny any of those, but I will speak to a couple if you don't mind.
Sure.
First of all, I think Jason Goes to Hell is an interesting choice because I think it's a very fun and clever film that sort of upends the formula of those movies. Yet, a lot of people don't like it because it's kind of like a you know, body possession film, you know, and
yeah.
Very different, you know. So that's an interesting choice that you've made there. I also want to point out that Tom Savini's remake of Night of the Living Dead will perennially be the movie that people need to see because they don't understand how good it is
yeah.
if they haven't seen it already. So many remakes out there, usually they're a disappointment. His remake is a go-to for me every spooky season to sort of get me in the mood,
mm-hmm.
and it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's a great one. I remember when that came out, I'm like, I have to see this. As reluctant as I am to see remakes, not all the time, but that one I was like, I'm in. Tom Savini, Tony Todd, you got me. And while I wasn't blown away by it initially, going back to it, I'm like, yeah, this is a much better movie. Well, I did the same thing with Day of the Dead. When Day of the Dead came out, I saw it and I was like, I don't know. This really isn't that great. It's really kind of depressing. You're underground.
Yeah.
It's in Florida. Like,
well, it's not.
You know.
It's not Dawn of the Dead.
No,
what everyone wanted.
And then
you know?
A few years later, I went back to it, and I'm like, "Damn, this movie's good. This is a really
oh, yeah.
underrated film." And
yep.
I did the same thing with Night. I'm like, you know what? This is a solid film, and more people do need to see this film. So I'm glad you said that, because yes.
Well, you're like Bud, you know. You need it to be enlightened.
Exactly. I got my Walkman on. really quickly, the 1980s were all about the mom and pop video rental stores. We get to the 90s, and all of a sudden, Blockbuster Video becomes the dominant force in video rentals. Can you talk about how much that changed the face of home video?
Well, there's pros and cons to Blockbuster. It's either, you know, and I think people's memories of Blockbuster are on both sides of the coin as well. You know, because they were ubiquitous. They were on every street corner practically. They were the Starbucks of video stores. And so people's nostalgia, especially if they were very young, is walking into this bright, clean, you know, colorful store where you could always get the video that you wanted 9 times out of 10. And they have happy memories. But those of us who were also there and recognizing what was happening, you would see that they were edging out the mom and pop businesses left and right. And not only that, they were so powerful, they were taking over Hollywood and dictating what Hollywood could put in their store. So not only were they approving certain movies that they would ultimately get on their shelves, they were also censoring films that they didn't deem were family friendly. And filmmakers were up in arms about that. That's a whole other story there. But, you know, I think it's just it defines what that whole era was about, where it became very commonplace to just go to the video store. People started learning that, if you didn't see it in the theater, it will appear in the video store, you know, anywhere between 4 and 6 months, now that window is even shorter.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people could decide, did they want to go to the theaters or did they want to watch it over and over and over again? And that time also evolved where you can, the price of the videotape went down to the point where you could actually get your own library, and it's affordable, and you can have your own movie library, you know, to the point where, you know, there's that one day, it's like, the sun shone through the clouds when all of a sudden, what was it, McDonald's or Burger King was offering, you know, the Indiana Jones, you know, trilogy on VHS like, what, $5.99 or something if you get a burger.
That's
I'm probably grossly misrepresenting that, but it was pretty much as simple as that.
Yeah.
Everyone was just like, oh my gosh, I could build my own library of my favorite films. And so, you know, there's so much to say about that era. But what's important in terms of 90s horror is that the gatekeepers, much like the 80s, the gatekeepers of the studios were bypassed by so many filmmakers who could just create content that would go straight to the shelves. And at first, it was buoyed by the mom-and-pop stores, and then, you know, Blockbuster, it seeped into that as well, and there was plenty of straight-to-video content that you could consume. And it made favorites out of movies like you said, Subspecies, The Full Moon Entertainment, you know, Puppet Master, and, you know, Demonic Toys, a movie I actually worked on. Yes, I'm old. And Ice Cream Man, you know, but movies that you just didn't see in the theater, but you're like, wait, what's this brain scan? That's kind of weird, but wait, it's got Edward Furlong. I loved him in T2. He was awesome in Pet Sematary 2. Let's watch this and see what it's all about. You know, you would never find that, or it would never sustain itself in the theater. But you could always rely on it being sitting there on the shelf waiting for its turn at the video store.
Yeah, it is so interesting. There is that love-hate with Blockbuster. It's so funny when I see, like, the mugs or somebody wearing a Blockbuster shirt walking around. I'm like, oh, yeah. Yeah, it's like
you
that.
You know, I'm all caffeinated, so I'm just jumping on you. Sharing your nostalgia, your thoughts about it, but there's just like a very strong nostalgia for it. I am ultimately a glass half full type person. And perhaps I look back and I had the last laugh, like many, that Blockbuster became too big to fail and then it failed.
Yeah.
You know, and they had the opportunity to buy Netflix when Netflix was new and fledgling, and Netflix essentially put it out of business. But looking back at Blockbuster, it was great to just walk into a Blockbuster, like I said, bright and clean and always had titles. And if you really wanted the more obscure, eclectic ones, you'd have to go to your loyal mom and pop store that was still around. Yeah. I worked at a video store, you know, that was a mom and pop, a tiny little place.
Yep.
And that was a happy time in my life being a video store clerk. So it's a fond memory of tactile searching, whether it's a record album or a library book or in a bookstore or going to a video store. The effort to go out, you know, not knowing what you wanted, just knowing you wanted something to consume that's entertainment or distraction or informative. Finding it, you know, the victory of getting the title that you've been trying to get to.
Yes.
And then taking it home with a stack of other things. Or getting that questionable title, maybe morally questionable to some people, but definitely not morally questionable for you, even though you wanted to hide it between, like, Bambi and Willy Wonka, you know? That's when Frankenhooker, you didn't put that one at the top. You had to mix those two in the others, but... Yeah, these are happy memories.
Oh, it must have fallen in from somebody else's batch.
And then there was as a red-blooded American male speaking right now, it's like when you discovered that one thing, like you're like, gosh, I'll never forget, and this is not horror, but I'll remember I saw, Sean Connery as a monk. Yeah, sure, I like Sean Connery. I'll watch it. It's got Christian Slater, too.
Yeah.
And then there's this very racy sex scene in The Name of the Rose. And I was just like, you know, it's like you discovered like a gold, you know, in a mine.
Yeah.
And you got to tell all your friends. You're like, oh, you got to see this movie. Really? The one about the monk? Who cares? No, trust me.
Just wait. Yeah, it's so funny. I remember trying to rent from our local place, trying to get an R movie, and I think I was 17 or 16. I don't know. I'm trying to, like, just get them to just, you know, sign me out with it. And, you know, they'd be like, do you have your ID? I'm like, no, I don't.
Well, that's why the mom and pops were good, because, you know, they were just like, they're used to seeing you, and they're just like, most of them didn't care. Most of them didn't care. Most video clerks didn't care. You had to find the clerk that wasn't like a school marm.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
But some people, there are many wonderful stories about people who they persuaded their parents. They're like, look, I watched this rated R movie and it was no big deal. Can you just write a note that I could show the videos for people that I'm allowed to rent rated R movies? I promise I'll just get the ones that are like horror.
Yeah.
And then they get their mom or their dad to write that. And then you're just like, ooh, it's like a license to kill. I can get anything I want now.
Yes. Speaking of getting anything you want, you're here not only to talk about the movie, but also talk about how to pre-order the film. So what can you tell everybody out there how they can pre-order In Search of Darkness 1990 through 1994?
Thanks for asking. 90shorror.com. 90shorror.doc. 90shorror.doc. 90s, 90shorror.doc.com. Our socials are still at 80shorror.doc. We didn't want to change that because so many follow it, but all the 90s stuff and information is on there. 90shorrordoc.com. Between October 6th and Halloween night, midnight, the spook, you know, the witching hour of this month, that's the time to jump on it and tell all your friends.
And my favorite time of the year is not only having you on to talk about this, but then I get to go through everything and tell everybody all the different bundles that they can buy, which we'll do after this interview.
Sure.
If people want to get In Search of Darkness 1980s version, can they still do that?
As we speak, there's ways to get it. There's ways to get it and check out all the socials for the information on there.
Gotcha.
You just got to check it out. As we speak currently, I don't have the specifics, but
sure,
it's all there when you get to the site in terms of what your options are.
Great. And then as far as when 1990 through 94 is going to be released, is that going to be January, February of 24? Is that the plan?
I do not know, and I do not want to. Based on the SAG strike.
Gotcha.
Things, you know, it's the Writers Guild strike and the Screen Actors Guild strike, which we absolutely support. That has put a little bit of a wrench in our plans.
Sure.
In terms of how we go about this. The film will be made, and it will be done in a good amount of time that we normally turn around these films.
Sure.
But I don't want to make any predictions in terms of the release date.
Totally understand and respect that. Quickly, Creator VC just announced a coffee table book for your 1980s science fiction documentary In Search of Tomorrow. What can you tell us about that?
Well, we just, you know, that's another thing where you asked, you know, why 90s next? And we were planning to do In Search of Tomorrow Part 2 as the next thing. But the clamor and the calls for 90s horror were just wonderfully deafening that we switched gears. And what we wanted to do is... Robin Block at Creator VC, he's been wanting to go into publishing and do companion books for our various projects. And this seemed like the best one to start with, since we didn't go straight to In Search of Tomorrow Part 2. So what this is it's a beautiful book. It's perfect for gift giving. We're putting it together now. It's, again, like In Search of Darkness 90s, it's a pre-order. But this one is expected to be ready by April 2024. Don't hold me to that, but that's the intention. But this is a 300-page 1980 to 1989 with 70-plus movies. There's movies in there that we didn't even cover in the documentary. It's sourced from the documentary in terms of all of the wonderful contributors and legends, you know, Ivan Reitman, Billy Dee Williams, Dee Wallace, all talking about your favorite movies, you know, Back to the Future, Ghostbusters, E.T., and so on. But another thing that's really cool about it is that for every single film, at the tail end of that page, the pages that we talk about that, you know, Blade Runner or Aliens, what have you, every single film will have a QR code. And you scan the QR code. You don't even scan. See, I'm so antiquated. You get the QR code, and what that does is that takes you straight to a bonus exclusive video, which is unseen content, unused content in the documentary, to further the discussion of the film itself. And that's exclusive just to this book. But what also is cool about this book is, like the In Search of Darkness movies, and we're going to do that for 90s as well, where you can get a credit in the film and all sorts of other cool things. You can get a credit as a supporter in this book for In Search of Tomorrow. But not only that, there are limited spaces if you want to upgrade. You can share your favorite movie memories of the 80s. You could make a dedication to someone that you love or lost. And you could also, on any of the movies that we talk about, you can literally pick the movie and say, I love this movie because, or something that was really memorable about Blade Runner was Ridley Scott's eye for, you know, detail. Whatever you would want to put, it gets to be on the page, the movie page, just specifically from the backers themselves. So you get to be on your bookshelf or on your coffee, you know, your coffee table, and you're immortalized. You get to be part of this whole process and be in the book and see yourself in the book. And so, much like we like to integrate and everyone's feedback and advice for our movies, we're happy to integrate everyone as well for the book. And I think that's pretty cool and unique and different.
I love that idea. I think that's brilliant, and it's going to be a huge seller. I don't doubt that. I think it's going to be huge.
Well, thank you. You know, yeah. One other little thing is that, you know, if you want to get it as a gift, we'll have a downloadable digital certificate that you can give to whoever you give the gift to, so they get something for, you know, from Santa Claus.
That's nice.
But what it's very cool that, you know, I think it's something that I'm very proud of. I know Robin is very proud of. And it's our first book out of the gate of hopefully many. and so we're really excited putting this thing together.
Well, you all should be proud. I mean, you've put together an amazing group of films. You're putting together these books. You're doing all the stuff. You're putting this great time capsule together for those of us that lived through it and can look back on it, and those that are young enough, too young to have lived through that time, they can go back and look at and see stuff. I mean, this is stuff that we really didn't have when we were young, to be able to kind of go through this. Different decades of movies and see things like this. I mean, now you're able to just do so much between the movies, the books, now the QR codes, you have added scenes. I mean, it's amazing. It really is. And if anybody wants to get that, it's 80ssscifibook.com. That's 80ssscifibook.com.
And yes, we also have 80ssscifibook, not to be confused with 80ssscifi.com.
Exactly.
So 80ssscifibook.com.
Exactly. And we have the trailer of the book on the Graveyard Show Podcast YouTube channel as well. It's awesome. It looks fantastic.
Thank you so much for helping push the word with
always.
I really appreciate you.
Always. That. Always appreciate you coming on here, and always appreciate the work that everyone at Creative VC does. I think the most important question that I have next is, what are your plans for Halloween?
Hey, it's spooky season, and I have a kid who still likes to dress up in costume, and so definitely trick-or-treating is my excuse also to put on a costume.
Nice.
It's got to be spooky and strange. It can't be, you know, I'm not going to be Charlie Brown. But although I would be Charlie Brown with the, you know, the ghost with too many holes sheet over his head walking around, I got a rock. I'd be happy to do that. But, yeah, my kid is absolutely, he's at the age where Five Nights at Freddy's he's obsessed with that. He's excited for the Five Nights at Freddy's movie.
Cool.
So we'll be doing that. And then he wants to be Spring Trap. And so anyone who knows, listen, if you don't know Five Nights at Freddy's, you have a kid, you learn quickly all the characters' names. And so, but he's like, Dad, you know, I want to make my own Spring Trap costume. I'm like, really? That looks very complicated. Well, look, all these people on YouTube did it, and there's these DIYs, and I'm like, oh yeah, well, this might be, oh no, this is really complicated.
Dad's going to be up late.
I also make documentaries and books in my spare time.
Exactly. Well, listen, thank you again for coming on the program to talk about In Search of Darkness 1990 to 94. Again, if you want to do the pre-order, that's 90shorrordoc.com. Stay tuned, everybody. I'm going to go over all the different bundles. Let's all say happy Halloween to David Weiner. Happy Halloween, David. Thanks for coming back on the program.
Thank you so much. Everyone have a great, great, great spooky season and a great holiday season. You guys take care.
As I put this interview to rest, it's always great having David on the show. It's been something I've been doing since late 2020 when I had him on to talk about his first In Search of Darkness movie. And it's kind of been an annual thing between the In Search of Darkness movies and the In Search of Tomorrow film that we talked about. It's just an easy conversation. We have fun. It's really great. And I always love having him on, not only to talk about his movies, but just to talk in general. I think we have a lot of the same interests. And it's just great. So I've said it before, and I'll say it again. He has carte blanche to come on the program. And we've actually done that one time where I think it was the first podcast I did this year was with David, and he called me, or emailed me, I should say, and was like, hey, I have information. Can I come on the show? I'm like, yeah, let's do it today, and did a podcast. So I think you can tell if you've listened to all my interviews with David how much fun we have and what a great time it is. By the way, if you heard an audio glitch towards the end of the interview when David was talking about the In Search of Tomorrow book, was not you. It was definitely there. We call that operator error. I made a boo-boo, and instead of trying to come up with some sort of half-assed editing on the interview, I decided just to leave it as is, and there you have it. So, yes, it was on my end, not yours. Now, I did promise that I was going to go over the different pre-order packages available for In Search of Darkness 1990 through 1994. I lied. Sorry. Unfortunately, the release date of that information was conflicting with my ability to record it. So the two did not sync up. So what I'm going to do right now is just say, listen, you've heard the information. If you've listened to my other interviews with David, you know where to go. But in this case, it's a new website. You're going to go to 90shorrordoc.com. That's 90shorrordoc.com. That's 90shorrordoc.com. 90shorrordoc.com. You're going to go there and you're going to find the information that you need to pre-order In Search of Darkness 1990 through 1994. I'm kind of sad because I always enjoy doing these, but I had to make a choice. If I waited for the information to be released, this podcast would have been delayed probably by a week due to my schedule. So it's just better for me to get this podcast up and out there, and the rest of you can do some legwork on that and definitely check it out. So go to 90shorrordoc.com to find out more about the pre-order for In Search of Darkness 1990 through 1994. Now, I do want to say this. During David's interview, he mentioned both the SAG and the Writers Guild strike. We obviously, we recorded that interview while the WGA was still in negotiations with their contract. Since then, they had come to an agreement with the producers that they were going to present to the writers to vote on. So that's why David referenced the Writers Guild strike during that interview. Just wanted to put some clarification in that, some perspective for where we're at that point. Now, what I do want to say is this as well. When it comes to having David on the show, it's always awesome. I love having him on the program, as I've mentioned. I'm also a big believer in the In Search of Darkness and the In Search of Tomorrow series. I'm a product of the 80s, as is David. We have great conversations on here, and I think that the work that he does, that Robin Block, the executive producer, and Sam Way, the editor, as well as everyone else associated with that series, they do an amazing job. And all I have to say is, to have the Graveyard Show podcast associated with the In Search of Darkness and Tomorrow series means a lot to me. So that's why I have David on here. I do get screeners, obviously, to prepare for my interview, not only with David, but for everybody who comes on the show. However, I put my money where my mouth is with the In Search of Darkness and Tomorrow series. I have bought every film that they have come out with. I bought a digital copy of In Search of Darkness after I interviewed David the first time. I have since purchased a physical copy of that, and I have physical copies as well of In Search of Darkness Part 2, 3, and In Search of Tomorrow. And if you want to fact check me, you can always go and look at the credits at the end of all those films, and you will see under G, Graveyard Show Podcast. So I believe in these films, and I think the work that everyone does on it is amazing. And it's a beautiful love letter to 80s horror and sci-fi. And I can't say enough good things about that. And I know, without having seen the new one, that this new 90s version is going to be off the wall awesome. So get ready. And if you're not familiar with these films, I believe Shudder still has all three that they are streaming. So if you have Shudder, take a look, find it, and watch it. I've said in the past, it's the fastest 5 hours you will ever sit through. On the next Graveyard Show podcast, I will be joined by author Richard Chismar. He will be here to talk about his newest book, Becoming the Boogeyman. It is a sequel to Chasing the Boogeyman. We're going to talk about those books, what it's like working with Stephen King. He co-authored a book with Stephen King, and he has worked with Stephen King on adapting some of his novels into movies and streaming series, and it's really great. Richard and I are going to go down a little bit of nostalgia lane as we talk about childhood and things that we watched as kids on TV. So that will be the next Graveyard Show podcast, which will be uploaded very soon. I'm looking at October 10th for that. Now, Richard is not the only guest that I will be having here in the month of October. I have more coming your way. Unplanned, unscheduled interviews are coming to you very, very soon. I'm not going to give away who they are. I want you to wait and see. So come back next podcast when I talk to Richard Chismar about his book, Becoming the Boogeyman, and then I will tell you who's coming up after that. I don't think you're going to be disappointed. I think you're going to like it. I have maybe 2 to 3 more interviews coming your way for October. That plus the new Catacombs of Horror, my favorite scenes from the film Blackula, is what's going to be taking up my time here in October. And I do it for you. I do it all for you. Okay. I hope you're enjoying it. And those of you that are joining me on the podcast and seeing all of you who are subscribing to the YouTube channel makes me very happy to see. Please take a look around. There's a ton of content there for you. And I hope you enjoy yourself and have some fun listening to these interviews and all my videos on YouTube as well. It's all there for your viewing pleasure. In the meantime, enjoy the Halloween season, and as you exit the graveyard, I would like to remind you to please lock the gate behind you. We wouldn't want anyone to get out. Until next time.